Hello, this is Dr. Laura Honest-Webb of VisionarySoul.com, author of The Gift of ADHD and Listening to Depression for the Sweet Spot podcast. Tune in weekly to find where your passion meets your purpose. This show is committed to helping you find, embrace, and live in your sweet spot. You can find us online at sweetspotpodcast.com and psychjourneypodcast.com. And today we'll be speaking with Dr. Scott Shannon, who is a pediatric psychiatrist and also a past president of the American Holistic Medical Association. He has written a book that we'll be talking about today called Please Don't Label My Child, Break the Doctor Diagnosis Drug Cycle and Discover Safe, Effective Choices for Your Child's Emotional Health. Well, welcome, Dr. Shannon.
Hi, Laura. Happy to be with you.
Well, I am a huge fan of your book, and as I would like to point out for listeners, that you are a prescribing physician, and yet you are saying that the knee-jerk reaction to treat a child who has some sort of a behavioral or emotional disruption with medications as a first-line approach has a lot of problems. Can you say some more about that?
I think it has problems for a number of reasons. The first of which is that we really don't have adequate science telling us that medications for kids are by and large safe or by and large effective. We do have some of that science for stimulant medicines, but for the majority of medications that we use, we just don't have adequate science. And I think we've gotten into a situation where, as Abraham Maslow would say, when all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail.
Absolutely. That it's just kind of assuming that any kind of a problem would be some kind of a brain or neurochemical breakdown. In fact, one of the things I love about your book is that you suggest that the first thing that you would assume instead of it that way is that we almost have it backwards, that there might, instead of something internal, that it could be something external. And you, in your book, goes through the 6 brain stressors. Can you review those and say, why? So if you're a parent and you have a child that's having some problems, there's 6 things you might want to look at before you jump to some sort of a diagnosis or drug. And what are those?
Well, let me just fill it out a little bit and say that my approach is really an ecological one. We know so much about the child's brain now that its defining characteristic is that it's plastic, responsive, and adaptive. Mm-hmm. And yet we try to pathologize the brain and ignore the total environment that the child's immersed in. And I think that's just, based on our current neuroscience, it's just a mistake and it's an antiquated perspective. Mm-hmm. So the perspective I try to take is look at these different factors that come in and affect the child's lives and know that we need to look under the hood and we need to see which of these issues are affecting the child so that we can understand what's going on with the child. And it just doesn't make any sense to medicate the child for ADHD when really what they have is a nutritional problem, an environmental problem, an educational problem, you know. And so that's really my point, is that we've got to find out what these factors are that are influencing the child's brain function from the outside before we blame the brain and blame the child.
Right. So that's a good, you're making a point that it's not so much the brain or the environment, but of course they interact so complexly, that it's at least good to start sorting through some of the other things. And the most obvious one seems to be relational. And then you also talk about nutrition and the environment and family and then education. And that's kind of a refreshing idea that there may be actually a problem in the match with the educational system or just with the educational setting altogether. And then, of course, trauma you talk a lot about, which is important not to overlook.
Yes. So those areas, and probably, you know, one of the ways that I differ most from conventional psychiatrists is that I believe nutrition plays a huge role in a child's life and that nutrition can either be a support or a stressor to the child's brain function. And unfortunately, what I see with the current sort of standard American diet, SAD, SAD, is that it's a very sad story, is that I see the majority of kids that I work with have very poor, impaired diets where they're not getting enough, certainly omega oils, B vitamins, minerals, and oftentimes even simple things like protein. So I find that by working with these stressors, such as nutrition and other ones that you mentioned, that we can make huge changes in the child's behavior and not have to look at medication. Because I'm really not anti-medication. I write prescriptions every day. But I think they have to be sort of a last line of resort rather than a first line.
Right. And I also like how you do point out that one of the strengths of the medication is that they are powerful and that they do tend to work more quickly than some of these other strategies. But I think you also point out that it is essential to get to the root cause. And if there are a deeper cause other than the brain chemistry, that overlooking that is going to make the problem get increasingly worse.
Yes. For example, looking at another stressor, education, what I find is that if kids are not in a learning environment that fits them or matches their learning style, preferences, interests, talents, gifts, that the child will struggle, will begin to hate school, will become marginalized, and typically by late junior high, they're struggling with depression and substance abuse because, you know, in their primary role as a child, which is that of student, they're failing, they're struggling. And it's partly because we've narrowed our school system so much with no child left behind, and we now have schools teaching to the test, and there's really no evidence that this has helped long-term outcomes for kids.
That's right. And it always comes to a surprise to me that when there is a problem at school, that the first place people look is in the child's brain, because, I mean, even as adults, you know, even adults who go to the office know that there's substantial problems that people have with, whether it be, you know, bosses or colleagues, and that's part of human nature. And so having a child that comes home with a problem and, you know, looking to the brain as the first culprit seems strange. You know, I know even like when I go to have to take CE courses for my license, you know, I always feel sometimes that I'm ready to hop out of my seat. And yet we think it's strange when a child expresses dissatisfaction with an education setting that could just be a terrible match for that child.
Yes, I couldn't agree more. So oftentimes what I do, one of my psychiatric interventions, is to help parents to understand the different styles, formats, approaches with schools to look at the fit with their child, knowing their child's strengths. Sometimes we need to do testing to sort that out. But then we can proceed with finding a better match, and often this can turn around the child more than giving them medication because all of a sudden they find some joy and purpose in their life.
Absolutely. And two of the other things that I found very powerful was what you talk about, you call it emotional education, and talking about that, there may be a place for it actually in the educational system. But I would say as a therapist, that's one of the main things that I do. And then the other thing you talk about is the difference between discipline and punishment. And I think those two points that you make really, I have seen turn what looks like ADD around in a matter of weeks, or sometimes months, but literally turn it around, which I think really challenges this idea that it was ever a brain disorder, in the sense of, you know, teaching a parent that I call it, when I say coaching before consequences, and also connection before consequences, you know, connecting with the child and coaching them, telling them what they need to do rather than getting angry and screaming and saying, you know, don't do that. Because, of course, then they never learn the right way to do it. So can you speak some more about those strategies and how you use them and what you tell parents about them?
Well, I tell parents the way I like to separate punishment from discipline is that discipline helps bring parent and child closer, and punishment pushes them apart. And really what I look at when I see kids that are oppositional defiant disorder, very often it's a stylistic issue between parent and child. It's a parent that's perhaps over-intrusive, and the child who's maybe insecure and wanting to try to establish their own control. And we get into a battle between parent and child, and everyone loses in this battle. Mm-hmm. And so if I can help parents to see the difference between punishment and discipline and move to a more relational-oriented model between parent and child, we can get around the oppositional defiant label and really improve things substantially for everyone in the home.
And have you seen cases or children who look like they had a fairly serious disturbance making some of these subtle parenting shifts and see things turn around?
Oh, yeah. In the book, I relate the story of Stephanie. and her mom. And her mom was an English teacher who was a little bit persnickety, and Stephanie was a tomboy who was strong-willed and very forceful. And she had been diagnosed with bipolar disorder, had had explosive outbursts, and had been hospitalized, placed on Depakote and Risperdal, had gained about 20 pounds. And she was enrolled in our day treatment program, where I was medical director. And what we found over time is that all of the outbursts historically had been between mother and child. There'd never been any school issues, never any dad issues, never any sibling issues, never any friend issues. And it became clear to us when mom left for 2 weeks to go to Kansas that everything was completely calm. So then we really shifted our thinking and process to work on understanding the style differences between mother and daughter and helping them to communicate better, respect each other, understand each other better. And as we improved this, the volatility of Stephanie's outburst went down significantly. And we were, within a few months, able to get her off her medication. And really, I called into doubt whether she was accurately labeled as bipolar. We think we just had a parent-child fit issue.
That's such a good point. And you also speak to the broader family system. And sometimes a simple shift in identifying the patient can actually make a difference. And you talk about the toll that parental conflict, for example, or family stressors can take on a child and lead to symptoms. Can you say some more about that and what a family should do in that situation, where there's, for example, parental conflict is maybe the real patient, but it's just creating so many stressors for the child that they're either failing or school or acting out?
Well, I think it's a huge issue, and children, I think, as we all know, are pretty effective barometers that they radiate sort of the stress and ambience of the home. And very often what I find is that if kids are struggling, if kids are anxious, unhappy, or not performing well in school, one of the things we really need to look at is sort of the family systems. And this in many ways is sort of classic old school psychiatry, but sadly it's a piece that I think we've left behind. So often what I do is I try to understand what's going on in the marital relationship, the primary relationship, and see how we can improve that to benefit the child. And what's interesting is I think one of the strongest motivators parents have is not to improve their own happiness, not to improve the state of their marriage, but to help their child feel better. And that oftentimes is highly motivating for parents to deal with the issues between them, where they before had been trying to ignore them and push them under the rug.
Right. That's such a good point. And the other thing I'll say to families, and I wonder what you think about this, is I think it's hard many times to get the husband to be interested in marriage therapy because I just think it's kind of a mismatch that many men tend not to think that model of going and telling a stranger your deepest thoughts is really comfortable. And so one thing I've tried to do and I've had some success with is telling couples that it's called marriage maintenance. And just as you'd go get your car, you know, oil changes several times a year, maybe you could go and get, you know, a few sessions of couples counseling several times a year and have had some success with reframing it that way.
Yeah, I think that can be useful. And I think just as verbal-oriented therapy does not always work for young boys, talk therapy does not always work for men.
Right.
And I think it's sometimes useful to have sort of a panoply of approaches when dealing with parents that, once again, if our only tool is marital therapy, then we may be lost in circumstances because I think there are many men that just do not put feelings into words very well.
Absolutely.
But oftentimes what we can do is just trying to get them doing more things together, trying to do more fun things face-to-face, outings where dad may be trying to teach something to mom or mom and child or both. And it becomes a different sort of event, but one where you're building connection, time together, and fun.
Oh, that's a great point.
And so I think there's a lot of other tools we can use besides therapy.
Yes, and when you talk also about the fun part, you also hit very clearly in the book the toll that a mother's depression will take on the child. And again, it comes back to that many times we see a child and it could be bipolar, it could be anxiety, it could be depression, it could be ADHD, and the first place we all want to look is in the child's brain. But a more obvious, more in some ways, place to look is the mother. And we do know there's a great deal of research that shows the toll that a mother's depression will take on the child. And how do you find that, and how do you communicate that to a family, and what's the next step if that's the case?
Well, the science on it is fairly clear that if mom is depressed, the child has four times the risk of being labeled and treated, diagnosed with a psychiatric illness. In one large study they did, they found that if mom got help, 33% of the kids lost their label, grew out of their illness, if you will, without any specific treatment other than mom's. On the other hand, in this group of kids they studied, if mom continued to be depressed, another 17% of the kids would go on to develop labels. And I think one of the most interesting things is it's not just depression. It's anxiety, it's behavior problems, it's explosive temper, it's even school performance issues. And it's pretty clear that this is, number one, a common problem. One out of seven mothers are depressed prenatally, during pregnancy or postpartum. And it's a huge problem. I'd say at least half of my practice now, the kids that I deal with, mom is depressed, has been, or should be in treatment.
Absolutely. And, you know, sometimes what I'll do, and this is just a quick way of getting at it, is I'll ask the mom that if I'm seeing the child and they're in the waiting room, you know, why don't you take a pad of paper and come up with a list of 10 things, you know, just complete the sentence, I need, and just complete that 10 times. Because it comes as no surprise that mothers are depressed. The expectations we have for mothers today are far off the charts and being unrealistic, and the guilt. And sometimes it's just as simple as shifting and helping the mother to begin to take care of her own needs in addition to everybody else's.
Yeah, and I think we've got to make sure that everyone in the family is getting their needs met, or the family can sort of deteriorate down into being labeled and medicated.
Absolutely. And now some of the other things that you go on to talk about that are astonishing are the numbers that you offer, having to do with, for example, the increase in rates. And you have numbers such that, you know, between 1987 and 1996, you know, the number of children being prescribed medications tripled. And that if this were to continue, that, you know, we would eventually get to where 50% of our kids were on medications.
Yeah, within a generation, if we don't change these current trends, half of American kids will be labeled and diagnosed with a psychiatric illness. And that just, I think, terrifies me that we're moving in the wrong direction, that we're not looking at these stressors, we're not looking at these triggers, this sort of ecological picture of the child, and that we're treating with medications which have real risks and really are inadequately proven.
Absolutely. And I mean, one of the greatest tragedies is, for example, in the cases where you see the mother that's depressed, and that's in some ways the cause, and then when you get a child where you give them the medications, I mean, part of the tragedy is that you don't solve the root problem, and the mother doesn't get the help she needs, and the child's real problems don't get solved. They still, you know, move forward with a depressed mother. And the medications are just controlling symptoms, in some ways hiding a deeper, more important problem.
Yeah, the medications are very effective at symptom management, and unfortunately that has led us to believe that they're doing more than they are. And I see a lot of continued suffering, even when we're managing the controlling the symptoms.
Now, the one other fact that one of many facts that you talk about that is both sort of jaw-dropping, but in my mind entirely predictable, is that when you look at the kids who are on medications, 65% of them are going to be taking more than one, and you specify specifically the antidepressants. And so I have my own ideas about that, but how do you explain the fact that once you go down the path of medication, it usually doesn't stop with just one medication?
Well, according to the New York Times, we, as of November of 2006, we have 1.6 million American children on two or more psychiatric medications, and we really have absolutely no science to back this up. Mm-hmm. We're flying by the seat of our pants. And as you say, it's sort of a slippery slope that once you sort of make that break in terms of believing that medications are the solution, and sometimes they can be very helpful,
right,
that once you start moving in that direction, then it's sometimes hard to stop at one or two or three medications. For example, in treating bipolar, we find these kids are typically on 3 to 5 different psychiatric medications.
Wow. And so that is something for parents to be thoughtful about. And to me, the message of your book, and tell me if you think I'm getting this right, is exactly what you said. You're not anti-medication. In fact, that's what you do. You prescribe them. But that before you go to the medication, let's look at all these other domains that you've just talked about, which, you know, nutrition and family and education and emotional resilience and these other areas, and then start to work towards medication as a solution or understanding it as a label rather than a stressor. And so I wonder, as you talk about, as we are going down this route towards 50% of children being on medications, if that's kind of the method and the message, which is to look at all these other things first. The medication will always be there.
Yeah, I think my, echoing what you said, I think my prime motto is that the better we understand the child, the more options we bring into their life, and the more safe and simple solutions. Because I think really parents are the expert about their child's life. I'm merely a consultant. I don't know the child as well as they do. And really what I help them to do is discover, uncover things, and learn how to use their own intuition to make significant positive changes in their child's life.
Wow, that's really excellent. And hopefully your book will be a force in solving some of the deeper root issues. That, you know, one of my biggest concerns is the tragedy of what doesn't get treated, what resources the child doesn't get when they just get the medication, whether that's, you know, emotional skills training or someone looking at the match with the education or the family recognizing there's deeper issues. So thank you so much for your book. And can you tell our listeners about your website, forthewholechild.org, and more about where they can find your book?
Well, my own personal website is wholeness.com, wholeness.com.
Okay.
And my book is available at many of the most bookstores and certainly with the online retailers such as Amazon and Barnes & Noble.
Wonderful. Okay, well, thank you so much, Dr. Shannon. This is such a great contribution.
Well, my pleasure, Laura, and happy to be with you.
Okay, take care.
All right, bye-bye. Bye.